behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Joseph Christopher, who's written a book called Sweet Silver, Investing for the Ordinary Joe. And Joseph works as a paramedic and certainly has an opportunity to see a lot of people in very serious problems and to work in emergency rooms. But of course, his avocation, his hobby, I suspect, is watching silver, watching investments, trying to prepare for the difficult times that lie ahead. In fact, the book really starts out talking about what people should do. And of course, as we've been telling you for a long period of time, we're moving into a period of financial chaos and crisis, and certainly this book was written some time ago, but it parallels very closely what we've been saying. And now, of course, as we begin to see the implosion of our financial system, many of our major banks are in real problems and having to go all around the world trying to get loans for the banks. And it has nothing to do with liquidity. We don't need more money in the system. We have a lot of banks. Our major banks in the United States and in Europe are insolvent, and they're having to borrow massive amounts of money. But even those massive amounts of money that they're borrowing are not going to get out of the pickle they're in, because so many of them hold massive amounts of bonds, and those bonds are not worth what they paid for them. They may only be worth 70 cents on the dollar, 50 cents on the dollar, 25 cents on the dollar. And if you have to sell things in an uncertain market, you're going to have to sell them for even less. So we've got real problems, and a lot of people are going to lose their jobs, and a lot of government jobs are going to shut down because the municipalities are going to not have enough money to pay people. And of course, here in California, we're talking about for next year, not this year, but next year, a deficit of $14 billion. They're going to have to cut 10% off of the bloated budget that we already have. The federal budget is going up. President Bush has told us it was going to go down, but it's really going up and going to be about $400 billion next year. And of course, that doesn't take into account the fact that it doesn't include the war in Iraq. They just put that off budget as if it's no consequence at all. Doesn't take into account the fact that they're stealing all of the money out of the Social Security Fund and the Medicare Fund and putting IOUs into this fund, and there's no money to pay for it. In fact, we're bankrupt as a nation. We're having to borrow $2.5 billion every day to pay our bills, and if governments are no different than people. They have to run on a solid financial basis, and we're certainly not doing that. Well, Joseph, certainly your beginning of your book is almost prophetic as you begin talking about how people have to get out of debt. Joseph, are you there? Oh, there we are. Oh, Joseph?
Got me now?
Oh, got you now. Okay, go right ahead.
Great pleasure to be with you, Dr. Stan.
All right.
Long-time listener of yours.
Whereabouts do you live?
I'm in Michigan.
All right, fine. And certainly, because you have quite a bit in there about Canada, I wasn't sure exactly where you did live. But anyway, certainly, let's get a little bit into the background of what you've said about getting out of debt and how important it is, you know, from a biblical point of view, not to do what everybody is doing, and that is just live beyond their means. But of course, the Bible tells us not to do that, doesn't it?
Most definitely does. Most definitely does. So many, not just Americans, but people around the world, you know, they want to have their cake before they've worked for it. And so much seems to be the American way to just spend and not worry about, you know, how you're going to pay for it.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, go right ahead. You know, one of the things that really bothers me is sometimes I see churches actually going out and borrowing money so they can enlarge the sanctuary. You would think if they had any faith in God, they would go ahead and try to collect the money before they took on a debt obligation. But many of our churches are acting irresponsibly as well. And then they have to get the money from the people to pay their debts.
Well, you're definitely right. Dr. Stan, and I've certainly seen that with my church as well, and it is a bit discouraging, you know, to see them put these phase programs in, and, you know, before they've collected all the money, they collect pledges and, you know, take on debt at, you know, 8-10%, whatever it might be, and, you know, then just expect that it's going to all be paid off. Definitely not biblical.
That certainly isn't. So what do you advise people to do?
Well, I definitely advise people that the number one thing you need to do is get out of debt.
Get out of debt, and I think that's the best advice in the world.
That's definitely it. You know, I feel no one should ever borrow money to buy into any type of investment, whether it's silver, gold, whatever it might be. And so many Americans are just, you know, they borrowed during the dot-com era to invest in dot-com stocks, and, you know, look where that got them. And they've borrowed all the equity out of their homes, you know, and now that home values have just continued to decrease, and certainly here in Michigan, I'm sure as it is in California, things are not good. There's many, many houses for sale, many houses foreclosed on, and many people just on the brink of losing their homes, and they owe, you know, they're upside down on their mortgages. They owe way more than the home will probably ever come back up being worth, and you know, so it's just a dreadful situation.
Well, you know, I think that this is really what's so fascinating and so tragic is that to many people their home was a piggy bank. And, of course, as the price, as the value of their home went up, well, they were able to borrow more and more and more money. And, of course, they could borrow every bit they possibly could. But, of course, then when the value of the house begins to fall, you end up, of course, owing more on their house than your house is worth. And, of course, the option would be just to get up and walk away. But in many, many states, you can't do that. You will be responsible. And you may have the bank take your home and put it up for sale, but you are going to have to pay the difference between what they sell it for and what you owe. And you will be maybe well be in debt the rest of your life. Hold on, we'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly the first part of Joseph's book, and it's only a small little book. It's only got perhaps, maybe about 100 pages in it, the most. But it basically talks about debt, and it talks about the tragedy that's befalling so many people who have borrowed excessively on their home, and they owe more on their home than the house is worth, especially as the price begins falling. And, of course, Joseph lives there in Michigan, and that state is sort of a basket case for the what's going on as far as the automotive industry is concerned. And apparently, you know, Detroit, a lot of these major cities there, they've got tremendous numbers of houses up for sale, being foreclosed on, being auctioned off. Sometimes, you know, they can't even get the value of the lumber in those houses when they put them up for auction. So what's the attitude of the people back there in Michigan at the present time as far as what's happening financially? Are they pretty well distraught by what's taking place?
Yeah, I would definitely say that the average person that I speak with is very distraught. And just as you mentioned, most people, when you mention to them that there is such a thing as a deficiency judgment that can be placed on them, they kind of look at you like you're crazy. But those are on the books in many states, and like you just said, you will owe, you know, if you had a $250,000 mortgage and they only get $100,000 for your house, you're going to owe $150,000, and you can best believe the banks are going to know how to protect themselves, and they know how to get it.
And, of course, the thing is, this is not true in every state. I don't think it's true in here in California, but I know it is true in many states. And, of course, the great tragedy is that people have always thought, well, I'll just go bankrupt. But you see, the people who engineered what's going on today knew exactly what was going to happen, because about 2 years ago, they changed the bankruptcy laws. So you can't simply walk away as you would have in the past from a bankruptcy and maybe you lose your good credit. No, they're going to get you. They knew exactly what was going to happen. Everything that's going on today, in my estimation, was carefully planned. And, of course, it's the way that it goes, they win, we lose, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, and the banks, of course, you know, are not going to take the loss if they possibly can. And, of course, there are lots of problems. The banks are in real trouble. Certainly our hedge funds are in real trouble. Many of our major corporations are in real trouble. The pension funds are in real trouble. And certainly many of these have bought these bonds, so-called collateralized debt obligations, where, of course, they've taken a whole flock of mortgages and put them together, or automobile loans, or credit card loans, and then, of course, the people can't pay off on them. But, of course, they were AAA bonds when they bought them because they were guaranteed by derivatives. They were guaranteed by certain companies like ACA and AMPAC and MBIA and others. But, of course, these people were making a lot of money writing insurance on bonds to make sure that they would remain AAA and they would pay. Trouble is they didn't have any money to make good, and it was fine as long as nobody, or as long as everybody was paying on the bonds. But when they didn't pay on the bonds, then these companies have to come up with the money. ACA had about $450 million and $69 billion that they were responsible for in bonds, and of course the others are pretty much in the same situation. And believe me, there are going to be terrible, terrible problems out there. It's only a matter of time. And, of course, then, of course, you get on into discussing the background of money and, of course, what money is. So why don't you talk about that, Joseph, because I think it's so important that people understand that money is not a piece of paper with green ink on it. Money is something of inherent value. Our founding fathers said that only gold and silver would be money. But, of course, they've been able to sell the American people on a totally fallacious concept. That, you know, as long as you can buy something with money, it's all right, but people don't understand the value of that piece of paper can dissolve literally overnight. Exactly. We go right ahead.
Well, you know, it just goes down to that they can continue to print and print more money with a printing press, and it's not backed by anything. And it's kind of interesting. I went to a local coin show today, and I had been for quite some time wanting to buy a gold certificate, an actual U.S. gold certificate, and I have one here in front of me, and it's actually a $20 gold certificate minted in 1934 by the U.S. Mint, and it says redeemable in gold coin payable to the bearer on demand. And so it used to be our paper money. You would go to the bank with this $20 bill or this silver certificate, and you would actually receive that amount in silver or gold coin. And of course our money no longer says that. It's a Federal Reserve note. Certainly just fiat money that they can print out of thin air, and when it comes down to it, what really backs the dollar is nothing more than faith. People's faith that it's worth something. And as that faith continues to erode and more people realize that money should be something tangible, you know, even in the very early days when you hear people speak of coppers, you know, that money was at least made out of copper or some type of metal that had some useful intrinsic value, you know, not just a piece of paper. And we certainly do not see that today. And when we see even the prices of the base metals, the coppers and the nickels and the zincs, just skyrocketing in price, not just because of industry use, but I think it has a lot to do with people just realizing that these tangible items, including wheat and soybeans and all these survival type, you know, our foods and whatnot, just going up in price, people are starting to realize and putting their money into these types of things.
Well, of course, I think that what most Americans are aware of is that prices are going up. Even the prices of the things made in China are beginning to rise, although they haven't risen as much as most other items. But, of course, we're going to see them rising more and more because we're going into an inflationary spiral. And the government is doing everything they can to conceal this from the American people, and they're frankly lying about the degree of inflation. And, of course, right. They tell us it's 2% core inflation, or maybe 3.5% or 4% if we throw in food and gasoline. Now, who out there in the audience really believes that the price of gasoline has only gone up 4%, or the price of heating oil,
exactly,
or of diesel has only gone up 4% over the last couple of years, 4% a year? And, of course, You know, are you going to believe what the government says? Are you going to believe your lying eyes? What about food? I mean, look and see what's happening to the price of eggs and certainly of anything that is anyway connected to corn, because they've created artificial shortages of corn as they, instead of allowing us to go ahead and drill for oil, and there's lots of oil off of our coast. There's massive pools of oil off the north slope of Alaska. And those of you who haven't got our 4-tape set on oil, or certainly read the little book that we carry called The Energy Non-Crisis, you need really to get the information. Understand we're being scammed. Exxon announced it made over $40 billion last year. Why did they make so much money? Well, if you have a shortage of oil, why, you make more money. If you have an abundance of oil, the price comes down. Chevron made probably $36 billion last year. Shell Oil did as well. Of course, they love this sort of a situation. They're doing great by creating artificial shortages. And, of course, you know, there's lots of oil off our shores. And if you have never read the story of that massive oil field that's up off the north slope of Alaska, we can't even drill in Anwar in the Arctic Reserve. Why? Well, it's because they want the shortages. And, of course, the oil companies pretend that they want to drill. They don't want to drill. They want to keep the artificial shortages. And you think gasoline is expensive at $3 a gallon? Wait till it gets to be $6 or $8 a gallon. And then there's also, of course, the sustainability element there. They really want, of course, to get us to stop using gasoline. Well, let's go ahead with your concept. Why don't you begin talking about money, what it is, and, of course, what people should be doing when they begin to understand that we're victims of a terrible fraud.
Well, most definitely, Dr. Stan. I wanted to mention a little bit, pick up on your point about inflation. And one quote I use quite a bit is the more of anything there is, the less it'll be worth. And I have in front of me here a Deutsche Bank note from 1923, and it's a 1 million mark note. And I think many of your listeners will probably remember the story in Germany prior to World War II, right after World War I, that there's a real famous story of the gentleman who had just a wheelbarrow full of money, and he went to go buy a loaf of bread, and he went in, and the baker wouldn't accept the money, and came back out, and all the cash was laying on the ground. Someone stole his wheelbarrow. You know, my point would be that certainly could happen to the U.S. dollar. Certainly has happened to other currencies recently in Argentina and
it's happening in Rhodesia today. That government that we put in power and promised the people there that we'd keep the country stable, they just printed a $10 million note.
Wow.
And, of course, won't even buy a loaf of bread.
Loaf of bread, right. And what I'm seeing, at least in my area of Michigan, and like you mentioned in the intro that I work in the emergency room, I'm seeing people who make good money. And they're struggling. Both spouses are working, and they're having trouble paying their bills. And it's not, you know, they're not even out of a job, and they're struggling. Heating bills have gone sky high. We heat here with heating oil here, where we're at, and it's out of sight. And, you know, so many people that it may not even be an unemployment situation, and they're still struggling.
Well, we had to fill our propane tank recently. It cost over $1,400. Now, admittedly, it was empty. But, of course, $1,400 to fill up our propane tank. And I said, $1,400? And the man said, oh, yeah, the price of propane's going up. Ladies and gentlemen, when they tell you that it's only 2% inflation, why would they tell you something that just flagrantly isn't true? Because most people will believe what they're told rather than their lying eyes. Well, our guest this evening is Joseph Christopher. His book, Sweet Silver, Investing for the Ordinary Joe. Fascinating book, and we'll be talking more about it here in just a moment when we get back from the break. Well, Joseph, you pick up the story there. You're talking about certainly gold and silver as the basis of our currency, and yet so many countries, in fact, most countries today, are just dealing with fiat money, with paper money, aren't they?
Oh, most definitely. It's not backed by anything. think a lot of people are under the delusion that we still have brick after brick after brick of gold in Fort Knox, and I think most of your listeners probably pretty fully realize that that no longer exists. The U.S. government's actually buying silver to, in order to continue its Silver Eagle program that it mints for investors. And so when it comes to precious metals, you definitely could say our government's bankrupt. You mentioned in your intro about the Iraq war and just the billions and billions of printing press dollars we've poured into that, and that's just debased our currency, and certainly foreign investors have begun to lose confidence in the U.S. dollar, and there are several oil nations that no longer accept U.S. dollars for in exchange for oil. And so I think we're seeing quite an unraveling of our currency, and it's time to protect yourself.
In fact, many of the foreign countries have set up something called sovereign investment funds. You know, some of the Arab countries is, say, maybe $200 billion into a sovereign investment fund, and they're coming over here. They want to get rid of those dollars because they know they're falling in value, and the dollar is falling in value and falling very rapidly, and so basically they're buying up companies. They're certainly investing in our major banking industries, and they're investing in many of our manufacturing, and they're buying up the infrastructure of the country. They're doing it very quietly. They don't want the American people to understand what's really going on, and certainly the mass media doesn't want people to understand what goes on. But when foreigners own the vast majority of your industrial capacity, and believe me, they already own well over a quarter of our industrial capacity, and that's brought out in my syllabus of our, goes with our talk on the financial tsunami, but they're buying up more. And of course, the profits will go overseas, and what we're seeing is the gradual destruction of the financial infrastructure of America, and it's not happening by accident, it's happening by intent. So, certainly, what do you advocate that people do at this point?
Well, obviously the first thing is to strive to be debt-free. You know, I mean, if you're deep in debt, you need... I go a little bit into detail in the book about ways to slowly pay off your credit cards and so on and so forth, but certainly I'm an advocate of silver and gold, and there's a couple reasons I'd like silver better than gold. Obviously, at the coin show I was at today, it's quite obvious that when you have gold over 900, in fact, it hit a high today of, I just wrote it down here, 937, and it came back down to, I think it settled around 907. The average person might go, well, you know, I don't quite have that, but they could walk away with several ounces of silver. And, you know, it's kind of the poor man's gold, I guess you could say, in some sense. And I think that'll do nothing but drive the price up. The demand for silver will continue to rise. It's an industrial metal as well as a precious metal, unlike gold. And its uses are just numerous, everything from cell phones to computers. And the thing about
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Joseph Christopher. His book is Sweet Silver. And Joseph is just saying that he's interested in gold and silver, but he thinks that silver is better than gold, simply because gold is so terribly, terribly expensive. And he commented that gold actually hit $937 for an ounce today, settled down about $907 an ounce for just 1 ounce of gold, whereas, of course, you're getting an awful lot of silver for that, for $900. And so silver is sort of the poor man's gold. But you picked the story up there as why you think silver is a better investment for the average individual.
Well, as I was mentioning, it has so many industrial uses, and the vast majority of the industrial uses, once the silver's used, it's unrecoverable. It's used in such small amounts in cell phones and computers, and it is the ultimate metal, conduction metal, and so it's definitely in demand. And then once it's used, it's unrecoverable because it's in such small amounts. So what we're seeing is that in 1900 there was approximately 10 billion ounces of silver above the ground. Now we're down to somewhere around 300 million. And much of that silver has just been ate up by industry. And so what we have is a very, very tiny market. And it would take very, very little investment demand to just drive silver sky high.
Yeah, and of course the thing is that the price is being manipulated, as the price of all commodities has been manipulated for many years. I mean, the cabal, the powers that be, I call them the CFR globalists, who really run our country and run the world. The CFR globalists have artificially kept the prices of most of the commodities down so that they could buy copper cheaply and buy nickel cheaply and buy zinc and the other base metals and then use them for their production. And that way they were, of course, able to impoverish the people in third world nations and of course, reward the people here in the United States. But it would appear to me that they just are not going to need America too much longer. I mean, they've been using our financial power and our military power to bring about the world government that they cherish, that they have dedicated their lives to establishing. But right now they're doing terrible things that allow terrible things to happen to our economy. And certainly we are the greatest debtor nation the world has ever seen. We are totally bankrupt. And if you doubt that, you can go to the writings of David Walker. That's David Walker. You can Google his name in. He's the Controller General of the currency of this country, and he works with something known as the GAO. And he will tell you that our debt is somewhere well over $50 trillion, the real debt. And there's just no way we can ever pay it off. That's all the things we're committed to providing, the Medicare, the Social Security, the Medicare drug bill, that there's no money. No money was authorized to do that. And as he just said, you know, there is no way we could ever pay off all of our debts, but we can't let the American people know that, or that one day, of course, we're going to have to inflate away our debt and, in the process, destroy everything the people have worked their whole lives for. So how you, of course, talk very much about the whole idea of buying silver, and you have quite a bit in your book about buying silver. So why don't you sort of cover that, Joseph?
Okay, well, I just am a strong advocate of holding something in your hand once you buy it. I know recently they introduced these ETFs, these exchange-traded funds, where you can buy silver like a stock and it's liquid and you can trade in and out of it. But I'm just a firm believer in taking possession of silver or gold and holding it yourself and not allowing some foreign bank or even in a safe deposit box. I'm just a real advocate of holding it as a store of wealth, as a protection against inflation. I mean, one example I give is, you had mentioned gas. Well, consider that in the last 10 years, gas has went from $1 to about $3 a gallon, and silver's gone from about 5 to around 16. So I guess you could say they've both about tripled. So in that sense, silver's really only about kept up with inflation. So my feeling is that it has a long, long way to go. Certainly not anywhere near a peak, nor do I feel gold is anywhere near a peak. Similarly, gold is pretty close to just over tripling, and it certainly has only kept up with inflation or a little bit better, and I think it has a long way to go.
Well, of course, our founding fathers were pretty smart people, and
yes,
they
wanted
all money to be based upon gold and silver coin. And, of course, they realized, of course, what had happened time and time again, whether it was in ancient Venice or ancient Florence or whether it was in ancient Rome or ancient Greece or what had happened in France in the early 1700s under John Law, what had happened in France in 1789 after the French Revolution. There's nothing new about a fiat money system. They always fail. They always go to its real value, which is zero. And we'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Joseph Christopher. And, of course, you know, Joseph, one of the hardest things for the average individual is the thought that our money could become worthless. And, I mean, people just can't believe this could happen here.
Right.
What do you say to them?
Well, when you try to talk to the average person, that's kind of one of the reasons I wrote the book. I did write it for, as the title says, the Ordinary Joe, and I was trying to write it to the people that I talk to every day out there, and to try to get them to understand that it can and will happen. I've given examples in the book, and I truly wrote the book with the intention of helping people, and helping people to understand that they need to be proactive in financial matters and, you know, the survival of their family and, of course, of our nation. I feel really depends on it, you know. And it's interesting, as I you're thinking over all this, that I'm looking at a Bible quote here, Mark chapter 11, verse 18, and it's where Jesus is in the temple, and he's quite angry, and the quote is, "You have turned the temple into a robber's den." And it's interesting to note that's the only time in the Bible that Jesus became angry. And of course, he was angry because they were using dishonest weights and measures. They were not using honest weights and measures. And I truly feel paper money is not a honest weight or measure. It's a form of stealing. Form of stealing from people, and I don't think it's too far of a stretch to say that it's an abomination before God.
Well, I certainly agree with you, and I think that people have to understand that. I mean, certainly, if you read the Bible, they stress the importance of the use of coinage, but it was a fixed coinage; it wasn't an artificial coinage such as we have.
Right.
Creating an artificial prosperity for artificial people for artificial times, and we have lived in one of the most amazing and prosperous times that has ever existed right here in the United States, whilst people throughout the world, almost half the world, lives on $1 or $2 a day.
Right.
Why, we have lived very, very well and very, very comfortably, and we have people here who have fabulous amounts of money.
Mm.
But, of course, increasingly, I think the middle class is under pressure, and, of course, I believe there's an organized, orchestrated effort to destroy the middle class.
Yeah.
So there'll be equitable distribution of wealth, not only within nations, but between nations. And we'll be back in just a moment here with our special guest, Joseph Christopher, talking about his book, Sweet Silver. Fascinating read, very quick read. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Joseph Christopher, his book, Sweet Silver. And Joseph, do you have a website? Do you want to tell our listeners how they could get copies of your book?
I definitely do. It is www.xlibris, xlibris.com/ the title of the book, which is sweetsilver.html.
All right, fine. Give that one more time. Because
I sure will. It's www.xlibris.com/sweetsilver.html.
All right, of course, the other way to get there would be simply to Google in either Sweet Silver or Joseph Christopher, or better, both of them. And do you have a phone number you'd like to put out?
I sure do. It's 1-888-795-4274.
All right. Now, the first thing you have to realize on radio, you always give your telephone twice. So
okay, sorry about that. 1-888-795-4274.
All right.
Fine. All right.
Now, well, anyway, of course, you listen to our program regularly back there? And
yes, I do.
Yeah. And of course,
quite enjoy it.
Joseph lives fairly close to Flint, Michigan, and of course, we have a big station there. We're AM 600, why we broadcast there every evening at this time for 2 hours. So that's we're very, very fortunate to have that outlet there in Flint. 600 AM. So basically, Joseph gets into the uses of silver. Only place I might disagree with him is I don't like to take silver internally because it's a heavy metal. Certainly, silver is one of the best bactericidal agents we know as far as used topically, used for burns, used for things of that sort. And I know many people take it internally, but I've seen too many people with black eyeballs, and I would look awfully funny with black eyeballs, and I'm not sure it's good for us. But be that as it may, I mean, everything else in the book is quite valid. You talk a lot about investing in silver stocks, and of course, you obviously have tried this. You like certain stocks. Some of them I know quite well, and I think your choices seem to be fairly good. Let me just put our telephone number out if anybody would like to call us. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And isn't playing the stock market a little risky, especially at times like this?
Well, it certainly is. It certainly is. But the way I look at mining stocks is I'd rather own a mining stock that actually has something tangible in the ground versus, say, a stock like a Google or a Yahoo or something that is strictly based on advertising. I think your money is much safer there. I do advocate in the book, though, however, before anyone considers buying any stock, that it's just my feeling that you should have some tangible silver and gold in your possession before you start playing around with stocks, because you're right, they can go down, and certainly in the uncertain times we're in, so many people buy on margin and just unwise things. So certainly when things go down, they're gonna be selling their silver and gold stocks as well, and that's going to make them go down. So
and certainly do not buy on margin, and do not get into commodities, because commodities is a great way to make a small fortune.
Yes, sir.
Out of a large fortune. And so
yes,
that's one of my favorite sayings, and it is really so true.
It is. I've had some experience with options and commodities in my younger days of trading, and they did not go too well.
Well, of course, the thing is that we're motivated by fear and greed. And, of course, it's greed that gets us in and fear that gets us out. And you get to the point you can't sleep at nighttime. And if I can give any advice from an older individual who's made a lot of mistakes, do not ever try to get into options. And of course, you get in there with greed. And of course, when they go up, you think you're so smart, and you think you're smarter than the system, and you're not. You don't stand a chance, because you're up against people who are a lot smarter than you are, and they will, one way or the other, get the best of you. So just steer clear of that, and there's nothing wrong with investing in stocks. In fact, I think there may come a time, if you, are out of debt, if you have a certain amount of gold and silver set aside, our guest believes that silver is a better investment than gold. We have other people who think that gold is better than silver, and we'll ask him to tell us why he thinks silver is so much better. But there's nothing wrong with investing in stocks, but you have to take it for the long run. And right now, of course, this is not a good time, because I think that the stock market one of these days is going to turn down. I don't know when it's going to turn down. Maybe a year, maybe 2 years. But I can see, of course, Richard Russell, who's one of the great investors of all time. They even talk about the Russell Index there on the stock market. And Richard Russell says he sees the day when the price of gold will cross the Dow Jones average. He made that prediction back in about 1978, and everybody laughed at him. And yet, of course, the market fell to about 800, and of course, gold went to 850. So he thinks it's going to happen again. And I wouldn't bet against Richard Russell, not for anything.
No,
in the world.
I wouldn't either.
So why don't you tell us why you think that silver is going to do so much better than gold? And if you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to talk to Joseph, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But why do you think that silver will do better than gold?
Well, there's quite a few reasons, but one reason that certainly comes to mind is that historically the ratio to gold and silver has been 16-1. And it certainly got to that level in 1980 when silver went to 50 and gold went to 850. And we're currently at a ratio of about 50-1 right now. So what that means is essentially it takes 50 ounces of silver to buy 1 ounce of gold. And so I certainly feel that it's going to go back to that ratio at some point. And I'm also a strong advocate of understanding percentages. When you understand percentages, you understand that when silver goes up 50, 80 cents, you know, in a day, it's actually going up quite a bit more on a percentage basis than gold. When gold, you know, goes up 8 or 10 or 12 and makes all the headlines, oh, you know, gold made another jump, and little silver only went up, you know, 50 or 75 cents or something. But you know, on a percentage basis, silver has been, you know, consistently going up more.
And I think that's a very, very valid point. And the thing is, of course, you need silver as an industrial metal. There's a very much of a shortage of it. There's probably not more than 300 or 400 million ounces in the entire world. The price is artificially, manipulated by the powers that be, as it were. I saw this, you know, this, well, just today. Silver got up to $17, and I think 17 cents, and closed down about, what, 650, 1650, 1655?
1679.
Right. Well, they manipulate these things.
They do.
And, of course, if you were in options or in commodities, you would just be dying on the
yes,
spot.
Yes, you would.
And we talk about fear, and that fear would motivate you, and you'd desperately sell because you don't know if it's going to go down even further on Monday. And, of course, they play games with your mind, and once you understand that, so much of what goes on today certainly begins to make a lot more sense. So, certainly there is very little actual silver available in the world today.
Right.
And if one of the Arab countries were simply to move into the silver market and buy up, you know, a couple of 100 million ounces of silver, which they could do very easily, why would drive the price right up through the roof?
Or drive it sky high.
And right.
And I give an example that if a Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or any billionaire, for that matter, even tried to move, you know, 10% of their portfolio into silver, it couldn't even be done because the price would drive up so high that they wouldn't be able to do it. It would just go up so fast because there's not that much available.
Well, let's go to our friend Tony up in
okay.
Spokane. And Tony,
Spokane, okay.
I've known him for many, many years. Hi, Tony. How you doing?
Oh, pretty good, Dr. Stan.
And, of course, I figured it had to be you because we're talking about silver, and I know you've been following that for so many years.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, when we moved up here, I had a literal ton of silver.
Right.
And I had to sell it. And since then, I've been slowly buying it back. And, I've probably only been able to get maybe 20% of it back so far, just because I've been so heavy into rental properties.
Well, I'm glad you got those rental properties. I think that was a really smart move on your part. And for our listeners, Tony, I sold his home here in the Monterey Bay area where I live at an obscene price, and I'm certainly glad he got it, because he got out just at the top of the market and moved up and started buying rental properties up there in the eastern part of Washington. And he doesn't even have to work. I think he's working because he loves to, but I guess he's working so he can buy more rental properties. But he thought this thing through, and he's got himself to a point where he's really secure for life.
Well, I have 8 rental properties. They all have positive cash flow, but I'm not buying anymore. I've been buying back bullion.
All right, fine.
In fact, I already told my wife I'm not buying any more rental properties. I got enough depreciation to keep me on the good side of the IRS. So I've been all my surplus cash now has been going into bullion and cost averaging. I mean, I was better off with what I had before I moved here, but it's been hard to reaccumulate it. But I have been doing it slowly.
Okay, fine.
But I have 2 questions. One for you, Dr. Stan, one for your guest.
All right, go ahead.
Well, one of the things that's been really bothering me about this whole subprime situation, I'm sorry, this doesn't have to do with silver. If you don't want to talk about it now, it's okay. Is that all of these people that bought homes with nothing down, they had to have mortgage insurance. Now, I haven't heard anything about where this is coming into play, which is why I'm really suspicious that this whole thing is a big scam, in that these lenders, how can they have losses when these people who bought homes with nothing down had to pay mortgage insurance?
Now, I don't know that they did. Are you absolutely certain? Because we've never heard
of it. Yes, because today Jim Cramer, I don't know if you know who he is.
Sure.
He's that mad money guy.
Right.
He's predicting that within 3 weeks, he came out today and said within 3 weeks, it's going to come out about how the insurance companies who've insured these mortgages don't have the money, and they're going to go belly up, and the Dow is going to take a tremendous hit to where the Dow will not even open, and it's going to cause chaos. And this was Jim Cramer.
All right, fine.
And it's the top story on 321 Gold today.
All right, well, Sydney, I have no question at all that, that Sydney, if they did have mortgage insurance, they're not going
to
have enough money to cover it.
You have to. If you don't put 20% down, they force you to buy it.
All right, fine. Well, of course.
So how can they lose money? I don't understand.
Well, of course, they're going to lose money because, very simply, because the companies that issued the insurance don't have the money to pay it off any more than the people who wrote the derivatives have the money to pay it off.
Exactly. Now, my question for your guest is, what do you think of Jason Hommel?
I subscribe to his newsletter, and I have since early 2006, and I am a fan of his. I've made some money on some of his stocks, and I've lost some money on some of his stocks, so I kind of do my own research, and he has some good tips. He has a lot good to say about the silver market. I think he's a good proponent for the silver market, but like with any advisor, I think you really need to do your own research. From what you know, take what they give you, take it with a grain of salt, and make your own investment decision.
Okay, Tony, does that answer your questions?
Well, sorta, not exactly.
Okay.
The reason I bring Jason Hommel up is because I've read his stuff off and on for probably over 10 years. And he has been making the case, and I used to think that he was crazy, but I'm beginning to wonder now. He used to make the case that silver would eventually become more valuable than gold.
Right.
And after reading Ted Butler for the same thing maybe 10, 12 years, and viewing the long-term drawdown of silver stocks as far as physical silver, and you mentioned earlier, I believe, that there at one point was over, I believe it was 8 to 10 billion ounces of silver just in this country. And now it's down to maybe only 150 to 200 million ounces in this country from that level.
Yeah, it's around 300 million, right.
300 million, or whatever. It's still a fraction of 8 to 10 billion because it's all been consumed. And gold is not destroyed or consumed for industrial uses, that it could go back to the levels it was when the Spanish were conquistadors were coming to the New World to take gold back to the to Europe, and that silver was more valuable than gold.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how it unfolds, Tony. Anyway, it's all really a game, you know. We can't take it with us, but it is a fun game to play, and I think that we really, of course, have to look after ourselves, our families, and of course, we put the programs on in hopes that the listeners will begin making preparations for the very difficult times that lie ahead. Hey, Tony, good to hear from you.
Well, can I ask you one more question?
Sure, one more.
Because I don't know if you or your guests know the answer to this one. Because I've been doing a lot of research lately into the hyperinflation of the Weimar Republic, pre-World War II Germany. My question is, with hyperinflation, are you able to use, well, let's just say you have a quantity, XYZ quantity of metal, gold, silver, platinum, whatever, okay? And the paper fiat currency basically collapses and it's worth maybe 1 to 2% of its value. So now you can change your metals into these basically worthless paper, fiat paper, monetary dollars, whatever you want to call them. Are you able to use those to pay off your debts?
No, but of course you can always buy money with those and pay off your debts. Okay.
I got
somebody else on the other lines, but bye-bye. God bless. Let's go to Mark calling from Oregon. Hi, Mark. How are you doing?
All right, Dr. Stan. I hope you're well. You sound great.
I'm doing so well. In fact, you know, it was very interesting. I went to a meeting today where my surgeon was talking, and he was saying that people who had the problem I did with aortic stenosis usually die in about 2 years, so I'm sure glad that I had it done, and
yes,
I'm really doing remarkably well.
Well, God and everybody else who cares about the truth, we all have a great reason for you being alive, and very much appreciate you. And also you, Joseph, thank you both for a very informative program. I just wanted to quickly mention that... I'll wait.
Go right ahead. No, go right ahead.
Just wanted to quickly mention that what I've discovered as far as the precious metal brokers, as far as what's called the spread or the differential between wholesale and retail, whereas you buy at retail and when you sell at wholesale.
You're absolutely right. And so you really have to, and not only that, but of course the markup will vary tremendously. That's why you've got to be awfully certain of the people you're buying with. And I just tell people to shop around. Don't take one quotation.
Right. What I found is that silver has on an average about a 20% spread, whereas gold bullion has on average a 5 or 6% spread, whereas the silver seems to have you have a 4 times greater spread.
Hold that thought just a moment.
Sure.
Okay, Mark, go right ahead.
Yes, sir. It seems from what I've found so far that you have about a 4 times greater spread to overcome with your investment as far as the increase of the investment just to cover, the differential where you're buying at the retail and selling at the wholesale.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you call me off the air, I will tell you where you can get with a 3% spread. That's all the markup that there is, and it's a really pretty good deal. That's where I do my shopping.
How do I call you off the air,
Doctor? Well, of course, you call 1-800-544-8927, and you ask me to call you back. That's 1-800-544-8927, and I share your concern. I think that an awful lot of people get taken. Believe me, there are a lot of sharks out there, and they sniff the blood in the water, and they're going to be after you.
I hear you.
Okay. My wife says to put you on hold, so I'm going to put you on
all
hold,
right.
And we'll get your number, and we'll give you a call back.
Appreciate
hold
it,
on.
Sir.
Bye-bye. All right, fine. Let's go to Jack calling from Michigan. Jack, you got a quick question because we're just about out of time.
Right. Whether he thinks the Kennedy Franklin heads would be worth purchasing, as well as the so-called junk silver Kennedy heads after 64.
What do you think about that?
I'm a big fan of junk silver, mostly because the production cost has already been long ago paid for. And usually junk silver is about one of the best ways to buy silver versus, say, like a silver eagle or even a silver bar. I'm a big fan of junk silver, and half dollars are a great way to go. And in detail, I got in the book the breakdown of it's approximately 3 half dollars equals 1 ounce of silver. So it's I'd be definitely in favor of that.
All right, anything else, Jack?
Yes, I just wanted Joe to know that I have the ear of a local pastor, and I'm going to see if I can't arrange for him, Joe, to at least speak with the pastor, hopefully to make a presentation to the congregation.
Of course, that's Jack from Michigan, so I guess you live
pretty
fairly close by.
Fairly close, correct.
All right, fine. Thanks very much. And if you need to know how to get hold of him, you have his telephone. Put your telephone number out one more time, Joseph.
Sure. It's 1-888-795-4274. That's 1-888-795-4274.
Great.
Okay, fine. Thanks very much. Anything else, Jack?
That's all, Dr. Stan. God bless.
God bless. Okay, fine. Well, Joseph, I want to thank you so very much for being with us this evening. My guest has been Joseph Christopher, his book, Sweet Silver, Investing for the Ordinary Joe. And it's very much down to earth. And people, of course, I'm not a financial consultant. We don't make recommendations, but we think you better make preparations for the difficult times that lie ahead. Good night. God bless. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners. Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and if you're in a position to help us, we'd love to hear from you. And maybe you'd want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And then, of course, if you have not yet made preparations for the difficult times that lie ahead, and they really are difficult, because I think we're entering a period of chaos and crisis. Why, for instance, if you're thinking about laying in a food supply, let me point out that the foods where we get our food from, ready reserve foods, the prices are just going up through the roof and there's certain other things like dried milk. They're having a terrible, terrible time getting, and of course they can all of these things, and they dehydrate them, and they do a really pretty good job. So do not put off. If you're in a position and you need some things, do not put off getting them. If you have a food catalog, an emergency food catalog, don't put off getting your supplies in. And if you don't have one, you'd like to get one of our catalogs. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Of course, we're carrying health products and things that Barbara and I take. And I'm in pretty good shape going on, almost 79 here. This month I'll be 79. And so if you'd like to get the health product list, and we're going to be carrying curcumin and quercetin as well. And, of course, several new things we've just put on the list, things we've learned about from our good friend Dr. Russell Blaylock. And incidentally, we will be putting together a four-tape set on Alzheimer's disease. Not ready yet. Don't call in and ask for it. But we think that the information we have now will be so beneficial to so many people out there. Because Alzheimer's disease is being allowed to spread. After all, if you believe that there are too many people in the world and they have to die of something, well, they might as well die of Alzheimer's disease. And, of course, I don't believe that. I don't, but I believe that there are people who do. And if you haven't read National Security Study Memorandum 200, came out in 1974 over the name of that great, great humanitarian, Henry Kissinger. We actually have that. You can get it off the Internet, but we have it, and it's nicely bound. It's an important thing to have. National Security Study Memorandum 200 tells you what the major thrust of American foreign policy really is, and it's population control, because they believe there are too many people in the world. Because if you haven't heard my talk on Nundare College genocide, or my DVD on planned population reduction, or a video on population control, or read my treatise on the population control agenda monograph, you really need to. You can get that. My treatise on the population control agenda monograph is up on our website, but if you want to get a copy of that and you get some of the other things, just ask for it. We'll send it to you. And then, of course, we have a great DVD put together by our friend Dr. Ayub, who made the mistake of listening to the wrong radio program and learned all about population control, and then he went off and started doing research on his own. And he's done a great job, one of the finest jobs, on with his DVD on Mercury Autism and the Global Population Agenda. Mercury Autism and the Global Population Agenda. You really, and if you get that, you get a CD-ROM with thousands of pages of documentation about the dangers of the mercury they're putting in the vaccines. They know that what they're doing. They know they're destroying the minds of our children, and they've destroyed the minds of so many of our children. Probably there's no child who's had a full dose of vaccinations that has had not had some damage done. But they've left the mercury in the vaccines we're giving to the third world children because we're so concerned about those little black and brown children in impoverished areas. That's why we're going to give them a neurotoxin that will destroy their minds and their fertility. Isn't that great? God judges nations. Since they can't be judged in the next life, they're going to be judged in this life, and I believe God is going to bring his judgment on America because, of course, men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. So remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like those catalogs we talked about, emergency food, health, and then a regular catalog or one of our newsletters, give us a call, and then please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming in from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests. And, well, for the next hour, our guest is William Grieg, formerly the senior editor of the New American Magazine, and today writing and doing radio programs. We're very fortunate to have him with us a couple of times a week. And what are we going to be talking about for this next hour, William?
Dr. Stan, I think it's important that we talk about some of the things that are going on with respect to the creation of a very detailed and overlapping network of federal, state, and local informants and provocateurs, and the way that common citizens are being set up, framed, seduced into doing things that are later used to build criminal cases against them, and even to be accused of terrorism, plotting terrorism. One thing I'd like to talk about that is not immediately related to that is what's happening right now in the Middle East with respect to the disruption of internet communication. And you may have seen the story earlier today talking about the fact that there's an unprecedented outage of internet service throughout the Middle East and Asia after, and I'm quoting now from a piece by British journalist Paul Joseph Watson, unprecedented mass internet outages throughout the Middle East and Asia after no less than 4 undersea internet cables were cut without explanation are spurring suspicions that a major event of geopolitical proportions may be just around the corner. And Mr. Watson mentions that the blackouts are having an impact on huge portions of Asia, the Middle East, and North Africa after 4 undersea cable connections were severed. Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Bahrain, Pakistan, and India are all experiencing severe problems. Notably, Israel and Iraq are unaffected by the outage. Now, I find that really ominous and somewhat familiar. Shortly after the war in 1914, the Great War, the First World War began, a British ship by the name of Talconia sent a large grappling hook down to the bottom of a shallow part of the ocean and dragged up the key undersea telecommunications cables that were used to connect Europe to the Western Hemisphere, and all but one of them were cut. The remaining communications cable was cut a few months later. There was an account of this in a book by historian Thomas Fleming about World War I, and he points out that the New York Times at the time this happened pointed out that all word of happenings in Germany must now pass through hostile countries, that is, hostile to Germany, Russia on the east, France on the west, and England on the north. That gave the British Ministry of Propaganda basically a free hand to shape the world impression of what was going on in the European conflict. And shortly after that happened, the world press was replete with these outrageous stories of lurid, terrible, ghastly atrocities being committed by the crazed Huns in Belgium. They were supposedly impaling infants on pikes. They were supposedly raping and physically mutilating women. Is this the sort of thing that's going to be happening now with respect to the prospective war against Iran? I think there's reason to think that we're being set up for a huge barrage of official propaganda as a prelude to a war.
Well, it could very well be. And unfortunately, this is the sort of things that governments do. And certainly, you have to get the people behind the war. You lie to them. Those stories during the First World War, about them Huns cutting off the hands of little Belgian boys and cutting off the breasts of Belgian women, there was no truth to any of them. And yet the American people believed in it. I remember talking to a young man who volunteered to go, to Europe to fight, to protect those Belgian women and the little Belgian boys. And what a disillusionment was when he got there. And it was all a lie. Well, you go right ahead.
I think it was Clarence Darrow, who was somebody for whom I don't have a whole lot of respect,
who was part of a fact-finding tour to occupied German-occupied parts of Belgium. There had been a reward put out for any information to corroborate, and just and one, to corroborate just one of the stories being put into circulation by the British Ministry of Information, and then the corresponding body that was created under Woodrow Wilson by a propagandist by the name of George S. Creel. And Clarence Darrow and his little group conducted a very broad inspection of those parts of Belgium where these atrocities were purportedly taking place. They were granted free rein to investigate what was going on. They weren't able to corroborate a single story, as you pointed out, Dr. Stan. And the fact that these internet cables have been cut, I think, suggests once again that somebody with an interest in manipulating world opinion in a certain way has intervened dramatically in order to set the stage for regional war, and the obvious target would be Iran. We've seen over the last few years the impact that internet journalism has had in countering the official line, the official lies with respect to Iraq and the way that the war is being conducted. And we've seen where people have had access through the internet, through such channels as YouTube, for instance, and some other modern samizdat, if you will. Samizdat is a Russian expression that refers to unofficial publication of suppressed facts. You know, internet samizdat has been one of the major ways that opinion has been turned against the war in Iraq. And people have been wondering, myself among them, how those who are clearly lusting for a war with Iran are going to overcome the fact that they don't fully control the media. Well, one of the ways you control the media is to go take out the major internet nodes and then make sure that all information about a given country would go through hostile territories, the way that Falconia, the British ship, severed the internet, not the internet connection at that time, the very primitive internet connections of a century ago, the telegraph wires, so that information had to pass through Russia and France and other countries hostile to Germany. And now all the information would go by way of Israel and U.S.-occupied Iraq. So we've got a situation here that I think is very ominous. Not many people are paying attention to it, but that's a really strong echo.
How long ago did that come out, William?
Just today.
Well, of course, it was suspected it didn't involve Iraq and Israel. Certainly, that is really a very, very strange coincidence, and I share your concern, because I think the Bush administration or the people who control the Bush administration are intent upon a war with Iran. I don't know where it's coming or when it's coming, but it's coming sooner or later. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is just talking about the fact that just a report came out today that pointed out that the internet connections for all of the Arab countries, almost all of the Arab countries, had been cut, accidentally cut, these major cables. And the only places they weren't cut were Israel and Iraq, which is occupied by the United States. Now, why would somebody have cut the internet cables for these other countries, but leave Israel and Iraq then intact? And of course, it's William's suggestion that maybe, of course, that they want to control the information coming out of the Middle East. And what better way to control it than to destroy the internet channels, which of course readily be used to disseminate information, so that everything would come through countries that were under our domination, and that we could then begin to control the reality and the stories that would influence the beliefs of the American people. So pick this story up there, William.
In recent conflicts outside of Iraq and in the Iraq war itself, we've seen instances of a cruder and more specific application of the same principle during the 1999 bombing of Yugoslavia by NATO, which was carried out for the purpose of installing in Kosovo a government controlled by allies of Osama bin Laden, ironically enough. There was an attack on SRT, Serbian radio and television, which was broadcasting accounts that were very critical of the NATO bombing and showing the consequences of the bombing campaign, that rather than being this antiseptic surgical procedure that we were being told it was actually wrecking havoc with innocent civilians who were very, very much like the American public. I mean, we're talking about a European country that was historically very favorably inclined toward the United States, even when they were ruled by Tito, who was a horrible man. The Serbs and many of the other Yugoslavs were very kindly inclined toward the United States, but the Serbs were notably pro-American, and The Serbs during World War II went out of the way to rescue a lot of American pilots who were being menaced by the Nazis. So when we saw people who looked like Americans on the receiving end of a bombing campaign, and these images were broadcast by the Serbian radio and television, they're showing that the bridges were being taken out. Every bridge over the Danube River was destroyed. There were bombing attacks that took out water and power stations that left huge craters in civilian housing tracts, and that, for instance, targeted on one occasion a civilian train. When these images were broadcast to the West, the way that NATO responded was by attacking the radio station and killing a number of journalists, civilian noncombatants, as a way of shutting down the broadcast of information that was seen as undermining the war effort. And then there was an attack early in the Iraq War on a hotel where a number of journalists attached to the Arab, I believe it's broadcast out of Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, the Arab media source called Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera is by no means an unbiased source of information. They have a very pronounced perspective that's generally expansively critical of the United States, much more critical of Israel, and so they certainly have their biases, their ideological slant. But they also have a variety of points of view. I believe they have a far greater variety of points of view and a far better track record in terms of reporting the objective truth than, for instance, the organ that calls itself Fox News. I think they compare very favorably, Al Jazeera. But there was this one attack that took place that killed a number of accredited journalists, civilian journalists, non-combatants, immediately after Al Jazeera had broadcast some footage of attacks that had left a number of unambiguous civilians, innocent civilians, dead. And so this is sort of the same kind of crude after-the-fact, case-by-case application of the same principle we're talking about, but we can actually identify the main nodes of Internet transmission and cut down all of them, but the two that run through countries that are ruled by governments either favorable to the United States or that are actually run by the United States, then you're obviously talking about the dramatic manipulation of information. And it has to be looked upon, I think, as the overture, the ominous grace notes toward what could be a horrible war. And I think, really, when you look at it, they have to accelerate their timetable because they're trying to get out in front of the advance of the collapse of the dollar, rather. I mean, as the dollar collapses, it's becoming more and more difficult to find people who are willing to buy in, you know, foreign sovereign wealth funds or foreign governments willing to buy into the American economy and to buy our T-bills and to keep the war effort going. I think right now they're going all in on a huge gamble, and the fact that these Internet cables have been cut and we're going to have all the information about this war, assuming that it comes about, being channeled through basically the governments in Washington and Tel Aviv, suggests that we're in for some very nasty events in the very near future, I'm afraid.
Well, I certainly hope and pray you're wrong, but I certainly wouldn't. I'm not going to bet on it. And because one of the publications I really enjoy is the Asia Times, which mm-hmm. is published over in Asia, and the India Times. They will give you an entirely different slant on everything, entirely different than you're going to get from the controlled media here in the United States. And believe me, the intelligence agencies have their agents planted in our various means of publication and distribution of information. And if you doubt that, let me suggest a book written by Lieutenant General William Odom, and it's called Fixing Intelligence. It was written in 2003. And, of course, William Odom headed the NSA, the most secret of all our intelligence agencies, and he can't tell us what's happening, but he could ask questions, and in the book he asked the question, should the CIA have journalists planted in the American media? And I think that's pretty revealing sort of question. You go right ahead.
Yeah, there's another book out called The Mighty Wurlitzer. I can't remember who wrote it. The Mighty Wurlitzer was an expression coined, I believe, by late, great H.L. Mencken to describe this grand instrument of media manipulation, the molding manipulation of mass opinion. And the Mighty Wurlitzer is all about the various ways that the CIA has dominated cultural and media organs since the creation of the CIA. And the fact that a lot of the institutions that are now looked upon as sort of the leaders of opinion journalism, for instance, the entire so-called neocon movement, neoconservative movement, began in the 1950s, and a number of publications that were subsidized by the CIA they were on the Trotskyite Marxist left. They were funded by the CIA in various ways, and now these people are basically they control the commanding heights of the so-called conservative opinion world. And one really good example of the continuing control of major media organs would be the role played by Anderson Cooper, who's a veteran of a CIA internship program. And just a few days ago, we had this supposed Republican debate where you had Romney and McCain and Huckabee being allowed to speak at some great length. And then Dr. Ron Paul, Congressman Ron Paul, who's a staunch constitutionalist, outspoken critic of the bipartisan interventionist foreign policy, was allowed response time that could be measured in the seconds. Literally, at one point, Anderson Cooper asked him a question and silenced him within 9 seconds, interrupted him, overspoke him, didn't let him answer the question he had been asked. He was allowed all of 9 seconds to speak. And Anderson Cooper is a product of the military-industrial intelligence homeland security complex that Ron Paul is opposing. And so it stands to reason when you have something like that moderating a debate, he's going to moderate it in a way which will probably give short shrift to somebody who's a critic of the very organs that produce that moderator. But that's a good example of what happens domestically and why we have to have access to foreign sources of news in order to find out what's even going on in our own country. And we, of course, have this vaunting pride about the First Amendment, the freedom of the press, and the great history of adversarial journalism. We don't have adversarial journalism in the mainstream media. We certainly don't have freedom of the press. The press itself is a corporatist oligopoly that is wedded at the hip with the government. You know, we have a corporatist media, not a free press. And so we want to have access to these other points of view in the foreign media, and now we see the downside of interconnectivity in the internet age. If you have a government that has the means to identify and the guile and corruption to interrupt those main nodes of internet transmission, suddenly we're cut off.
Well, that's somebody had called in and said that they thought that they'd been repaired, but they weren't certain. I think we can tell whether this is going to have any significance as to whether these are repaired, because they could repair those in 48 sure. hours if they really wanted to. Let's just wait and see if they're repaired. If repaired, then there's nothing to worry about. If they're not repaired or there's some terrible complication, then we'll know, of course, it bodes poorly for the future.
Well, something else that we could say is that maybe this is an example of the big boys clearing their throat and letting the people who are in charge of those media interests in Asia and the Middle East, letting them know who's really controlling things and warning them what could happen in the future. I mean, it's a shot across their bow. That's another possibility. I mean, you kill one to terrify 100, Lenin said, and so you have an instance or two where you've actually seen journalists being killed as a very crude instrument of information management. This is perhaps a more sophisticated variety of the same tactic. But you're right, we should make an effort to see whether or not those have been repaired, those internet connections have been repaired, and see what comes out as a result of this. But anyway, this is just a very dramatic and very unsettling development. Even if we go no further than this, it's something that leaves me quite convinced that we're in for some ugly times very soon.
Well, I think it's only a matter of time. The question is, I can't imagine them doing anything before Super Tuesday, that's for sure. And
yep.
I suspect that once, of course, they have the candidates selected, and they may very well be selected next Tuesday, then, of course, they can do whatever they want to. But the one thing they would not want to do would be, of course, to attack Iran before Super Tuesday, because that would, I think, give a lot more support to people for Ron Paul, who certainly says we ought to get out of the war, we ought to bring our boys home. But I think what people have to understand is they have no intention to bring our boys home any more than they have any intention of winning the war over there. They intend to leave our boys there stationed permanently. They've got to have a certain amount of violence and instability to justify keeping our troops there. But we didn't go in there to get rid of Saddam. We didn't go in for the oil. We didn't go in to help Israel or to protect our currency. We went in there to justify keeping our troops there permanently, and I think that also to have them there for a base for the coming war with the Muslim world. We'll be back here in just a moment.
You know, you know, James Madison, and this is something that I've adverted to on several occasions when talking to the doctor, Stan. Dr. James Madison talked about the fact that of all the enemies of public liberty, war is the most to be dreaded because it encompasses and develops the germ of every other. War, he said, is the parent of armies, and armies breed debts and taxes, and armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the subjection of the few. And we're dealing here with a situation where we're supposed to be on a permanent war footing. John McCain talks about us staying in Iraq for 100 years or longer. Dick Cheney on several occasions has said that we're talking about a conflict that's going to define our lives for the foreseeable future. Condoleezza Rice has talked about this being a generational conflict. And it's not going to be confined merely to the foreign battlefields that occupy our attention when we're talking about loved ones, fathers, sons, parents who are sent overseas on this fool's errand into Mesopotamia. We're also talking about a domestic front where the government's going to be aggrandizing its power. And the domestic front and the so-called war on terrorism involves the creation of this network of joint terrorism task forces that run literally thousands or perhaps tens of thousands of informants and provocateurs. And I suspect that every informant basically is a provocateur in the making or can be tasked to act as a provocateur. Provocateur is somebody who incites others to commit acts that can be treated as criminal offenses or that are in some sense going to undermine the cause for which the victims of this scheme are fighting. So if you have a provocateur who shows up, for instance, at an anti-war rally and suddenly starts to hurl obscene insults at the police and suddenly starts to suggest violent direct confrontation with the police and the other authorities, the purpose of that act is to discredit the cause of opposing the war in Iraq, to use a good, obvious example. A provocateur can also be somebody who entraps a targeted victim in a criminal scheme in some way, gets that person materially to aid a conspiracy to commit a criminal act. In this case, we're talking about terrorism. And all you have to do in order to be charged with conspiracy to commit terrorism is to further in any way, materially, the supposed plot. You don't have to come up with a plot. You don't have to volunteer to carry out the lethal element of the plot. All you have to do is provide some kind of material support to be considered a co-conspirator. And so what will happen in many instances is that one of these informant provocateurs working for a joint terrorism task force will be tasked to approach somebody who seems like a reasonable mark and find out what that person's interests are, push the right buttons, offer the right kind of help, get that person to start thinking in terms of direct action of a criminal nature based on his political interests, and to provide or to claim to provide or to have the ability to provide the material means to carry out a plot that that person never would have dreamt of had it not been for the intervention of the informant or the provocateur. And this has happened time and time and time again. We've seen in the last several years all these high-profile supposed terrorist plots, the purported plot to attack Fort Dix, purported plot to attack a naval station in San Diego, the Seas of David plot in Florida, the plot against Sears Tower, the Lackawanna 6 case up in, I believe it was upstate New York. And time and time again, we find that really there's no material evidence that these people actually were preparing to commit a terrorist act, but rather that engaged in loose talk that in the context of what we're...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Grigg, and he's simply talking about the fact that the government is planting agent provocateurs all across America, informants, agent provocateurs, and these people will come to you and they'll say, oh, you know, the government's terrible, and of course usually they're going to Muslims, and maybe we ought to blow up the Sears Tower, maybe we ought to blow up the Brooklyn Bridge, or, you know, suddenly, you know, we've got a plot against this country that's been treating the Muslims so badly, and you get some poor, impressionable, not very smart Muslim to sort of go along with this, or certainly doesn't want to be offensive, and then the next thing you know, he's suddenly indicted as a terrorist, and these thoughts never would have crossed his mind if he had not been talked into this by a fast-talking provocateur who is getting paid fabulous amounts of money so that we can create the impression that there is this real terrorist threat in America, and yet almost every one of the attacks that's been planned in America has actually not come from the individual, but come from a government agent who planted the plan and provided the weapons, if there were any weapons at all, so that they could put these poor, stupid people into prison. So you have to be very careful, anybody you talk to today. They could well be a government informant trying to trap you. So please pick up the story there.
I think the best way, by the way, to anticipate the question that at least some of your listeners are likely to ask, what do you do about this? Don't do or say anything that you wouldn't be prepared to be accountable for. I mean, I will be perfectly candid about my political opinions, about my opinion about the government. The government that rules this is a criminal enterprise. It's a criminal syndicate. It is the most formidable and permanent enemy of everything I hold dear. I will tell anybody that anytime, anywhere, and I'm perfectly prepared to accept the consequences for saying so. And I believe that there may be indeed a time and a place to use lethal force to defend myself and my family against aggression by any criminal of any stripe who represents any organization. I do not believe in initiating violence. I do not believe in aggressing against the rights of any individual. I do not believe in violent subversion. I don't believe in indiscriminate violent attacks against people, even when I am provoked to violence. And I think that those principles apply to anybody. I certainly wouldn't commit violence against a private citizen because I don't like his politics or I don't like the policies that he supports. I wouldn't commit violence against a government official for the same reasons. You know, I am not a violent man. I am a Christian, and as such, I'm commanded to... as far as it resides within me, to seek to live at peace with all men. But the point is that when you take a look at the history of our founding and take a look at the fact that you had Christian statesmen who understood that there is indeed a time when you have to resist the aggression against your rights by arms if necessary, that's part of our heritage. I don't disavow it. And so I think that it's important that people understand that if you're worried about somebody in your midst being a note-taker, being what the Russians call the stukach, or an informant, just assume that you're going to be held responsible for everything that you say and all the principles you espouse and all the tactics that you endorse in terms of applying your principles. Just don't get in the habit of having one face that's for public consumption that's different from the face you show in private to people. Just try to be consistent. That's all you can do. That's the best you can do.
Well, I think what we really have to understand is that there is a criminal organization in America made up of traitors who have sworn to uphold our Constitution and hate America. And these are the CFR globalists. Of course, they're a front for a secret society. Most of them don't even know that. But there's no way that you can be a globalist and be a good American. You can be a globalist. You have a right to disagree with America. But you don't have a right, of course, to swear an oath to uphold our Constitution and then set out to violate it, like Condoleezza Rice, who is a member of the CFR, like our president, who is, although not a member of the CFR, he's controlled by Dick Cheney, who is, and also a member of the Trilateral Commission. And these people's loyalty is not to the United States.
Yeah.
It is this globalist dream. Now, this is the Treasonous Act, and if you read the Patriot Act, you'll find that anybody who wants to change our form of government is a terrorist.
Yeah.
And by that definition, the CFR globalists, and their headquarters is at 58 East 68th Street in New York City, New York. That's 58 East 68th Street, New York City, New York. These people are terrorists. They've been terrorists since they were first formed back in 1921. But remember, they are a front for the secret society that Cecil Rhodes formed back in 1891. And that's all covered in a book by a Professor Kara Quigley, who is Bill Clinton's mentor, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. The book was actively suppressed for many years, but it is available through Radio Liberty. It's so vitally important that if you're out there in the listening audience, you understand what this is all about. And we have to call these people what they are, and nobody wants to call them traitors and treasonous, because there is no way you can support a world government and, of course, support our Constitution and certainly want to maintain our freedom. We're going to be back here in just a moment with William Grigg as we explore what's going on today and, of course, the progressive loss of our freedom and the fact that you should be very concerned, because there really are people out there all across America who are paid to try to entrap you. Well, this is Dr. Stan. You go right ahead there, William.
When we're talking about a government that would seed communities with informants and provocateurs, you're obviously talking about a government that's at war with its subjects, because free governments, or governments in free society, I should say, free governments being something of an oxymoron, governments in free societies don't treat citizens that way. They don't treat citizens as the targets of this perpetual aggression against their liberties, and so informants aren't necessary unless you're talking about those rare circumstances where a criminal cabal actually exists, and you can turn one of them against the other so as to help build a case that has to be corroborated on the basis of physical evidence and testimony of other reliable witnesses against the criminal syndicate in question, criminal cabal in question. But when you've got a community where you don't know who the provocateur is or under what circumstances you'll be under surveillance. Surveillance, of course, is a big, big enthusiasm with the government that's ruling us right now. You're not talking about a free society. You're talking about a surveillance society, something that is approaching the contours of totalitarianism. And I'd mentioned that we have these 102 joint terrorism task forces that are set up across the country. That's more than one, an average of two per state. And of course, you'd have more in certain populous states than you'd have in others. There's probably only a regional joint terrorism task force that would encompass the state of Idaho, for instance. But these are, I think the best way to describe them, Homeland Security Soviets. They're little councils that combine the FBI and elements of the CIA and the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, with certain elements of the Department of Homeland Security, for instance, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, and also individuals from the IRS, as well as state and local police. They're multi-leveled. They have, within the context of the task force, certain subgroups that focus on specific types of potential terrorism or specific types of criminal activity. And there's also, in every joint terrorism task force, an ongoing liaison effort to train and indoctrinate local police into the counterterrorism mindset, which is defined as the 1% solution. There's a terrific piece by Rolling Stone magazine called The Fear Factory that has a remarkably detailed and substantive examination of the role played by these joint terrorism task forces in creating these supposed terrorist plots, these supposed terrorist conspiracies. And there's an FBI agent who is quoted, a special agent who is involved in the training of local police, who's quoted in this story talking about Dick Cheney's 1% solution. And the definition that Cheney applies to this is the following.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is William Grieg. But before we go on, and we're getting into some very interesting things about these joint terrorism task forces, I want William to tell us, you and my listeners, how they can get to his website. Now, William, of course, has a website, and it's really a blog site, but there's a lot of great information there, and then he's written a book that I'm sure that everybody in the audience would want to get, and one of these days we hope we're going to get a supply of them.
I promise you we'll soon.
All right, fine. But anyway, why don't you tell our listeners how they can get to your blog site, and then we'll get back to the subject we were talking about.
The easiest way to find what I write is to go to the right source, and the web address for that is www.rightsourceonline.com. That's one word, rightsourceonline.com. If you go to that, that's the front page, or the home page, rather, of the Right Source Media Enterprises, which is a project of the Welch Foundation in California. If you look at the top, you'll find a banner ad for my new book, Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. And if you scroll down about, a quarter of the way down the page, look at the left-hand side of the screen, you'll see my photograph, and there'll be a hyperlink there that will take you to my daily blog, which is entitled Pro Libertate. It's a Latin phrase that means for freedom. You click on that link, and it'll take you to my blog, which is updated between 3 and 5 times a week, depending upon what my schedule is like. And I generally publish an essay of roughly 1,200 to 2,000 words, and the essays are intended to be works of investigative polemics. I have a point of view, I don't disguise it, and I have very strong opinions, I express them, and I try to make factual and validate what I say on various issues of interest. this isn't a blog like your common weblog that involves brief, pithy reflections on what's going on in the world. I'm trying to publish full-orbed opinion journalism pieces, and we do the same kind of material at the Right Source as well. We do have links to stories. We reproduce and carry stories in the press. But we also have opinion pieces that we publish and videos that we post. And there's a terrific series, just a horrifying series, but a terrifically well-produced series of YouTube videos by my associate Tom Edlam on the Right Source website. I think it's a five-part series based on some elements of my book. And the series that Tom has produced is entitled What Can Be Done to You Right Now in Terms of the Powers that the Government Claims Over Your Person in the Name of Homeland Security. And that's the name of the first chapter of my book, Liberty in Eclipse. And if you go once again to the Right Source website, rightsourceonline.com, you can click through the banner ad on top, and you can order my book for sale directly from the Right Source. I believe that we're charging $10 a copy for a book the list price of which is $12.95. It's soon going to be available on Amazon for the full list price, but we're still going to be selling at the website for $10, so sort of undercutting our market, I suppose, at Amazon. But we'll also make it available soon to you, Dr. Stan, I promise. I've been in touch with folks in California and New Mexico over the last couple of days, and I'm going to make sure that hopefully early next week we'll get your quantity of that book to sell.
All right, fine. Thank you so very much. All right, fine. Well, why don't you go right ahead now?
We were talking about the 1% solution, which is the ideological framework for the war on terror. It is defined by Dick Cheney. The mindset is this: if there's a 1% chance that a terrorist incident could occur, then we should devote 100% of our energies on the assumption that it will occur. If there's a 1% chance, we should treat it as if it were a certainty. And so the role of provocateurs, of informants and provocateurs in the scheme, I believe, is to produce that 1% chance by directing their attentions to people who can be manipulated into presenting this facade of terrorist intent, and then this is treated as an active, viable conspiracy. Now, obviously, this is something that is done by way of image maintenance, by way of tuning the atmosphere to keep people constantly alarmed or at least manipulable in the interests of aggrandizing government power and trying to promote a public support for dubious policies. But as well, I think that this is something that's being done by way of creating a self-sustaining machine. Look, I mentioned that we have these 102 Joint Terrorism Task Forces. According to the best research that has been done on this subject, and to my knowledge, the best research is that of Professor Alexandra Natapoff of the Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. She's testified before Congress. She's written a number of law school journals on the subject of informants. And I believe she's actually working on a book on the subject, which would be a fascinating, albeit somewhat terrifying read. She's exhumed from the budget requests of the FBI and the DEA the figures that they admit to, in the case of the FBI, 15,000 confidential informants on their payroll, and the DEA admits to having 4,000 snitches on its payroll. I suspect that that's a number which is a lowball figure in both cases. And, of course, we also have hundreds of law enforcement agencies at the state and local level, all of which are pretty much tied in by subsidy and regulation to the Homeland Security apparatus, all of which run informants of their own. So we're probably dealing with multiples of that figure, roughly 20,000 federal informants that they'll admit to. We're probably dealing with multiples of that figure across the country that work at all levels of law enforcement authority. And almost all of these people, I believe, probably something north of 90% of these informants, come out of the war on drugs. They have drug convictions of some sort. They might have drug convictions in addition to convictions for actual violent crimes or crimes against persons or property, crimes of fraud. But somewhere there's a drug nexus. And because of the federalization of the war on drugs, the fact that there's this bizarre twilight zone jurisprudence that takes place with respect to the war on drugs and the Bill of Rights, these people, when they have a drug conviction, are in a much worse state of affairs with respect to the sentences that they're going to confront and the prospect of getting out of jail anytime, not just anytime soon, just getting out of jail anytime. So they're always looking for a downward departure from the mandatory minimum sentences, and those mandatory minimum sentences are usually pretty stout. And under, I believe it is Section 51K.1 of the sentencing guidelines, you can get a downward departure from your mandatory minimum sentence by agreeing to become a cooperating witness, a cooperating source or informant. So there's this huge and self-replenishing pool of informants created by the war on drugs, most of whom are either black or Latino. And so these people, many of whom go to prison at some point and become Muslim converts in prison. And by the way, if we're really interested in stopping or arresting or slowing down the propagation of radical Islam in this country, we ought to call off the war on drugs, because we send these people to prison, they come out as Muslim converts, usually converts to jihadist Islam.
But I have to remember, of course, the reason they do that is because Saudi Arabia is sending over their their imams here to actually go into our prisons, or allowed to go into the prisons, they're paid by Saudi Arabia, to create these terrorist movements. In fact, the entire world terrorist movement is largely funded either directly by Saudi Arabia or indirectly by Saudi Arabia and by Pakistan. And, of course, we're working very closely with both of those. And how much of that money comes from the CIA, we don't know. But I know that we are doing creating the best enemy that money could buy. We know that in the past they funded Al-Qaeda. We know that our government funded the Taliban. If you don't believe it, read George Bush's speech of the 20th of September 2001. You can get it off his website. He'll tell you the United States was the greatest source, the largest source of humanitarian aid to Afghanistan prior to the September 11th attack. Afghanistan was, of course, the Taliban. We were funding the Taliban, and now we're killing the Taliban.
And we were giving them counter-narcotics funds, if I remember correctly, as late as, what, June or July of 2001. So that, of course, is a way of underscoring the farcical nature of this charade that we're engaged in with respect to Al-Qaeda. And one more note here with respect to the propagation of radical Islam in prison, another reason why people who go into prison on drug convictions or other crimes of that sort often find themselves being caught in this undertow and being recruited into Islam is for protection. That's another reason why you see a lot of these Latino gangs and white supremacist gangs as well thriving in prison, because people are seeking the security of a collective of that sort. I mean, prison's a very dangerous environment. It's nice to have people who will watch your back and protect you against the other predatory bands that exist in prison, and so you end up with a lot of people joining with black convicts in particular, joining with Islamic groups in prison on the assumption that people will come to each other's aid should they be in danger. But a lot of these people graduate from this prison madrasa, this prison seminary, and they come out and they end up becoming confidential informants for the FBI and these joint terrorism task forces. And one such specimen is a fellow by the name of Michael Crisman. He has played a role akin to that of Johnny Appleseed, if you will, of planting the seeds of these jihadist conspiracies in Illinois, and also through contacts with some of the people he's met as far abroad as far afield of Illinois, rather, as San Diego, California. It's like he's the Johnny Appleseed of jihad. And he's a cooperating source or a cooperating informant whose nom de guerre is Jamil. His history is that about 14 years ago, when he was in New Jersey, he was a drug dealer who was involved in armed robbery and car theft, and so he went to prison, came out a hardened man with three wives and nine children to support. I mean, I believe we're talking about serial monogamy as opposed to polygamy here, but he had three wives to whom he had obligations and nine children, not very good employment prospects, so naturally became a confidential informant for the FBI. And sometime in late 2006, he was in Rockford, Illinois, and he approached a fellow by the name of Sharif, who was a 22-year-old fellow who had the misfortune of being raised in a home where his father belonged to Louis Farrakhan's Nation of Islam. And Sharif had a dead-end job as a video clerk at a video game store. He didn't have a house. He didn't have a car. Somehow the FBI decided to set this kid up as a jihadist. So they threw this Mr. Crisman at him, this Jamil. Within the course of a conversation, basically a cold conversation at this video game parlor, this video game store, Jamil, the federal informant, invited Sharif to come live with him and his family, which, of course, was a tremendous blessing because the kid really didn't have any place else to live. and Muslim hospitality, the canons of Muslim hospitality say that basically if you meet a fellow Muslim, you can, you really are under the obligation of providing him with a place to stay and with food to eat and so forth. And so he ended up staying with Jamil, and Jamil, after taking him under his wing, started to cultivate within this kid a jihadist mentality. He started to indoctrinate him in radical Islam and talk about the need to commit terrorist acts in order to strike back at the great Satan, and filled his head full of all kinds of rhetorical tropes about the evils of America and Israel and the Jews and so forth. And at one point, finally, he convinced this kid to record a tape-recorded message of jihad, talking about the need to bring down the great Satan America and the little Satan Israel. And although Sharif, the youngster who is the subject of this treatment, had made it clear he didn't want to kill anybody. I mean, when talking about potential terrorist attacks on government buildings, he said, we ought to do this during the holidays because that way nobody will be killed. We'll just be blowing up buildings. The federal informant convinced him that he should carry out an attack on the local shopping center there in Rockford, Illinois. Rockford's a relatively small town. I've been there quite a bit. A very nice community, but very unremarkable. And this kid was convinced that on a certain date he could go to a specific address, a store, and exchange in the parking lot his stereo speakers for a handgun and for grenades to carry out this attack. And of course, when he showed up, he was arrested and charged with a terrorist conspiracy involving, get this, a weapon of mass destruction. A hand grenade is considered a weapon of mass destruction for the purposes of creative sentencing, I guess. And so because this individual had been inveigled into doing this video denouncing the United States and Israel and talking about jihad, and because he had been manipulated into showing up and looking to buy hand grenades, he was pretty much required to plead guilty to charges that he had been suborned, or rather charges of, for criminal acts into which he had been suborned to do. Now, the FBI claims that they can't really tell you everything they know about this guy. That he's a really bad guy. He's connected to this vast network that goes all the way back to bin Laden. And the reason why they say that is because there's another case that this kid was supposedly connected to that would have involved attacks on military facilities in Arizona and San Diego. And this was the supposed work of another fellow by the name of Abu al-Jihadi, who was a U.S. Navy veteran. And as it happens, they have many surveillance recordings of this al-Jihadi fellow as well, some of which involve him referring to the confidential source as an idiot, and on one occasion saying, look, you've got it wrong, I'm not a jihadi. This is not what I want to do. I'm not involved in waging a holy war. They do have video surveillance tapes of this Abu Jihadi guy saying that under certain circumstances it would be okay to attack a military base if, for instance, the order came down for all American Muslims to be rounded up and detained in military bases, then it's okay to wage a defensive jihad for the purpose of freeing people, innocent people who are wrongly detained. That's a little bit more subtle question than saying we should just haul off and attack an American military base sua sponte. But the thing is, the same confidential informant that set up this 22-year-old eccentric by the name of Sharif set up this other guy, Abu Jihadi. And Mr. Jihadi, I guess, is going on trial in March of this year. But you see here where this guy, who's this convicted criminal, in addition to dealing drugs, he also committed acts of violence to steal property from others. This guy who has every reason, every self-interested motive to say whatever he thinks his handlers would like, he's the guy who's going from person to person, from American Muslim to American Muslim, and radicalizing them or trying to, and setting them up for prosecution. And that's pretty much paradigmatic of how this network of informants and provocateurs works. There's another case that resulted in acquittal last December of the so-called Liberty City 7. I believe this is a group from Florida who were accused of plotting an attack on the Sears Tower. And I think that the cumulative IQ of these seven people is somewhere south of one standard deviation below the norm. These are not Mensa candidates, folks. And these are definitely not, you know, wiry, taut-bodied, bold, intrepid commandos. They're just, you know, seven eccentrics from Florida who were accused of this plot to commit what was called a full ground war against the United States by plotting a attack on the Liberty, or attack on the Sears Tower in Chicago. Well, the jury saw that the government had 15,000 surveillance recordings of the guys, including one in which they swore allegiance to Osama bin Laden, but the jury refused to convict because the defense was able to demonstrate that the person who wrote the script for this entire supposed conspiracy was, once again, the convicted criminal who was the confidential source. The FBI's provocateur assembled the conspiracy and basically wrote out a script with blanks in it and tried to get these guys to plug themselves in to fill the blanks.
Well, you know, the whole story is just so incredible, and of course they'll not only try to trap the, Muslims, they'll try to trap other law-abiding American citizens. We know, for instance, that during the communist era, why most of the people belong to the Communist Party were FBI informants, the Aryan Nation, the Ku Klux Klan, the militia here in the United States, they were all funded by your tax money. We'll be right back here in just a moment.
Well, there was a piece of folk wisdom that was passed around back in the 1960s, back when FBI was running its COINTELPRO program, which was used to wage a war of disinformation and psychological manipulation, and also infiltration subversion of various groups that were considered to be enemies of the status quo or radical anti-establishment groups. That piece of folk wisdom dictated that if you were part of an existing political group that was considered somewhat marginal in terms of its opinions, and somebody showed up and suggested that you should go out and start blowing things up, that person was almost certainly a federal informant. That the informants were the people who talked about committing acts of violence or acts of vandalism or acts of terrorism. You know, you could tell who the feds were. They were the most radical and most violent of the people who just showed up. And indeed, that was the case here with this group, the Liberty City Seven. The defense attorney who won the case said to the jury and quote, "This was all written, produced, directed, choreographed, and stage designed by the United States government." And the jury bought that argument, so they acquitted the seven because they were convinced that the defense had made a sound case showing that the federal confidential informant was playing the role of a provocateur and trying to suborn these people into doing things they hadn't planned to do. And as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, by no means should we assume that they're only targeting the Muslim community. They're doing that, obviously, because that's the selected enemy du jour, and that's the natural coefficient of this war being waged abroad. And this impending war between the larger Muslim world is likely to produce an even stronger thrust in the direction of creating a domestic front against the Muslims in this country. And I think, interestingly enough, if you take a look at this guy, this Michael Crisman fellow, who is the provocateur in the two plots in Illinois, his biography is very, very similar to that of Jose Padilla. Mr. Padilla, I believe, was originally from Brooklyn. He was a street gangbanger who went to prison and then got out of prison as a Muslim convert and ended up being sort of caught in a radical undertow, but didn't do anything that would be facially illegal. He was just he was just guilty of having opinions that are, I think, you know, quite frankly, bizarre and indefensible, but you don't punish people for their opinions. But when he got off the airplane in 2000, and I believe it was 2002, and was charged with the plot, being part of a plot to detonate a dirty bomb and taken into custody and designated by the president an unlawful combatant, an enemy combatant, he was presented with a deal by his would-be FBI handler, where he would have become an informant, and I'm quite convinced a provocateur, just like this Michael Crisman fellow. The biggest difference is that Jose Padilla didn't take the deal.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and well, we're out of time. We could go on for a good long while, but our guest this evening has been William Grigg, and we'll have to wait till next week to get some more of these stories.
Sure.
But I think we should all be very, very concerned when the government actually tries to talk people into making statements that will incriminate themselves, and it's all a game, because they have to have a certain number of terrorists to justify taking away the freedom of the rest of the American people. After all, if there weren't any terrorists, why, how could we be fighting a war on terrorism? So they go out, they pay people fantastic sums of money to entrap people into making incriminating statements. Oh, this is certainly not the America that I was raised in. Good night, William, and we look forward to talking to you next week.
Thank you. God bless.
Okay, and you too. Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, that was certainly William Grigg, and certainly one of our favorite guests, and we always love having him on our program, and I hope you enjoy him as well. And, of course, this is the time when we need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and if you're out there across America, we hope that many of you, if you're able to, will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and to help us as we reach out 5 hours every day and every week, almost 60 different outlets, and we are reaching people, we're getting them educated, our audience is growing, and people are beginning to understand the foundations of our freedom and how we're losing them, and they're beginning to understand that we do have a criminal syndicate in Washington, D.C. They are CFR globalists. John McCain is a CFR member, and of course Hillary Clinton's husband is a member of the CFR and been to the Bilderberger meetings. These elitists who have a different agenda, because of course they want to destroy the sovereignty of our nation and merge us into a one world government, a one world religion, and with a one world leader. And that's what it's all about. Frankly subversive, but of course nobody has the courage to say that, for if treason doth prosper, no one dare calls it treason. Well, ladies and gentlemen, certainly we hope that many of you will go to our website of RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. If you'd like to know about the CFR, we have, of course, a four-tape set called the Secret Government. And then we have another one called Secret Societies. And then, of course, you can get that part of the Secret Government special. We have my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. Very important. It will give you the background of what's really going on today. If you want to understand the myth of communism, you need to read Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. Now, it's not that communism is not brutal and inhumane and has not killed 60 million people, but you must understand it's been funded and supported by the Anglo-American establishment since its inception. And as Professor Quigley says at the end of the chapter, with those pages 952 in it, and I've forgotten the numbers at the end of the chapter, he says, you know, most people thought that it was because there were communists working on our government, that Eastern Europe and China were turned over to the communists at the end of the Second World War. And there were communists working in the government, but they weren't the ones who were doing this. It was the Anglo-American establishment, and that's really true. Everybody thought it was because of the communists working in Time magazine, and the communists working in the New York Times, and the communists working at Harvard. They were put there as a diversion, so people would not understand that there was this other movement. That's why Professor Quigley's book is so vitally important. Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, actively suppressed for many years, available from Radio Liberty. And you can get that along with a interview with Professor Quigley and the book Foundations, Their Power and Influence, going into how the Rockefeller and Ford and Carnegie Foundations have been funding communism and subversion since their inception. Now, the book was written in 1958, but nothing has changed since that time. There is an elite group who actually fosters communism, works with communism, and then pretends it's their enemy, is funding communism today, both in communist China and in communist Russia. Although we're not sending as much money to Russia as we have in the past, why, we're still sending them money and paying their scientists finding one reason or another to funnel money into communist Russia that has reserves of $440 billion, and the United States has no reserves. We're having actually to borrow money to pay our bills, $2.5 billion a day. Please pray for America. Pray for Radio Liberty.
Tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating through the void of Yah's creation. It is, take a deep breath. Oh, man, it finally is here. Friday. Friday, the 1st of February, 2008. Yeah, I'm still trying to get used to that 8. I will tell you, folks, there are veterans that are very, very upset. Did you happen to catch Fox News?